All right, friends. I think we're just about there. If not, we're maybe a few seconds early. And I want to welcome you to our continuing work on identifying as being. It's such an elusive subject because as St. Francis said, what we're looking for is what is doing the looking. We always have to get behind the self that's behind the self that's behind the self until we come up with the final observer in any particular universe. And of course, we have the ongoing idea that the great breath is a perpetual motion and has had a duality that had no beginning and had no end. So our whole work here is at once very obscure and elusive, and then in another sense, the simplest thing in the world. Literally, the simplest thing. There is none other than it. So there is no second, the one without another, or the one without a second. I'd just like to welcome some of you as the survivors of this process. And of course, Michael Stacy is here to help us stay on the boat, and hi, Annette and Aurea. And Joe, hi Joe, and Joan, and Juhi, Karen, and Leslie, Lori, and Lorraine. Anne, it looks like Anne is coming in here. Anne Peterson, and I hope I don't want to forget anybody. Catherine, Miro, and Martine, and Margot. Yeah, I think that's all I see at the moment. And, other people may join us along the way. Yes, we talked last time about the different methods of identification. And I suppose, given someone close to us who is the initiator that we will meet in the initiations of the threshold, namely the Christ, the head of the hierarchy, he is the great expert in the art of identification. And so much of his teaching is meant to help us achieve even a little bit of what he has achieved, because with that achievement will come all those good things that we need to make the divine plan, to bring it into expression. We need, in the state of identification, the universe is light, and love is all pervasive. And the great archetypes of our particular hierarch, let's call our hierarch as the planetary logos, or if we extend that idea, we will go to the solar logos, in whom we are a kind of a tiny little atom within the solar logoic manifestation. It's just that what we seem to be gets tinier and tinier as we expand these great knowledge of these great ones in whom we live and move and have our being. So that maybe we become the tiniest of things as we really begin to look at the possible expansions. But on the other hand, this is a very practical approach to sensing, identifying as the livingness of all things. We are the life of all things. What I want to do is kind of, stop occasionally and just have us meditate on some different seed thoughts. I'm working on this seed thought book, and I hope that before long to have it ready. It just keeps expanding, so I have to kind of do what the hierarch of any universe does. I have to say, thus far and no further. In other words, I have to finitize my little book on infinity. that's exactly what on his own tremendous level, the deity of the universe, the universal logos, has to do exactly that. Otherwise, every one of a sequence of universes would be infinite, and that, of course, is a contradiction, one that we can avoid. So let's just, we can work with some things that DK gave us, but we can also work with some simple seed thoughts, which will help us make the transition in our busy, illusory, myopic lives into the sense of unlimited selfhood. Now, even the universal logos has what we might call, for practical purposes, it has limited selfhood. It's a finite being, and it has drawn its own boundary, as it were. It's bounded. Now, immediately that asks you to contrast the state of a universe with Blavatsky's first fundamental of the secret doctrine: there is a boundless, immutable principle. It's the only thing that is, and it's boundless. So even the huge universal God is bounded. And we are used to boundedness in our own lives. We're this and we're not that, we say to ourselves. But of course, we are the that that we say we are not. And that kind of realization, although it's not all about the specifics of the science of relationship, is a very fundamental realization that eventually has to be ours in increasing measure. So we want to, through the art of identification, which, sometimes it's a hazard. If you identify with the wrong thing, if you identify with form and with the externalities of life, you automatically cramp your sense of identity. Now, so many of us are living with a cramped sense of identity. It is absolutely shriveled up compared to the limitlessness that we are. But of course, then we have to enter a type of thought which is against normal thought. All of our normal thoughts are based on what I would call finitization. We deal with finite things in a finite way. Everything has a bound everything has a limit, and this is different from that. And that's how we manage the great Mahamaya. That's how we manage the relational universe. But what we're looking for is the non-relational essence. That's really what we're looking for. I mean, if you're looking for it, if you're actually looking for that. And I guess there comes a time when you get tired of form, because form is not real. And you have a thirst for the real, because the real is what you are, and what you are calls out to what you are in all things. In other words, you're not confined. You are a, I've just seen myself enter the group here, but that's okay. I've entered the waiting room. I hope that you are hearing me and that there are not two of me right now. That would kind of defeat the purpose of what I'm trying to say.
You are here.
So we're being heard. There is the great science of relations, and inside the universe, that is what occultism teaches, especially spiritual occultism, not just power-hungry occultism. Because if you're dealing with the dark side of the Force, as they say in the Star Wars epics, you are blind. You're not catching the wholeness at all. It's only with spiritual occultism that we begin to catch the wholeness. And have some intimation of our limitless selfhood. I mean, if we can in this life, this incarnation, develop at least a hint, an intimation of our limitless selfhood, we will have done a great deal. Now, I don't expect that we tiny emanations, as we appear to be, can do anything like what a great Logos can do. The Logos himself, planetary, solar, cosmic, supercosmic, ongoing, Logoi, they too are working on the hypothesis of limitless selfhood, even though they have a huge presence when compared with other lesser emanations. See, I think, and I'm going to get into it one fine day here, that no matter how large any being may be in terms of its field of activity and its boundary, it is exactly identical in scope and magnitude to every other being, greater in scope or lesser in scope. There's myopic scope, where things seem to be big or little, and then there is absolute scope, in which the size of everything is exactly the same. Now, I know that sounds kind of like a weird thought, because we're so used to being in Maya, but I could look at the largest whatever and the tiniest whatever, and their absolute magnitude, their absolute size is a existent, dimensionless point. of exactly the same scope as every other dimensionless point. So we'll get into that at some point. We'll get into that because it begins to show us, you know, that time and space, the way we usually consider them in the big Mahamaya, are really illusions. Or what did Kant say? They would be categories of mind, or categories of perception, or categories of consciousness, but they're not real. And the occultist takes it even further and identifies only one reality within universe, and when the universe, a universe, does not exist. See, a lot of people think, okay, the universe exists forever. That's like saying that Mahamaya and form exist forever, but they do not. The universe has a term, any universe, that who knows what that term is. Blavatsky calls it kind of seven eternities. That's vague enough, isn't it? So every universe has a term according to the inhalation and exhalation of the great breath. And in a way, what is the breath? What is the great breath? But periods of self-observation and periods of non-self-observation. When the universe is in session, you know, like you're having an inning. My old teacher used to talk to me about innings and outings, you know. And the universe is the big inning. And it's like play ball, you know. But then comes the time between the innings, and we're no longer at play. So the great breath controls that. And what determines whether we're at play or not is whether the great observer observes itself or does not. When it observes itself, there is a universe. So the universe is an act of universal logoic perception. Every universe is an act of universal logoic perception, especially the details of the universe. And every disappearance of a universe is an act of universal logoic non-self perception. I wonder if I should write that down, you know, I'm liable to forget it, and so are you. So a universe, a universe is an act of universal logoic self-perception. I know this is a language a little different from DK, but you know, it's another way in, another way to try to understand reality, and a period of no universe is an act, what can I call it, of the withdrawal of universal logoic self-perception. In other words, I'll put it really simply, a universe is self-sight. This is, to be is to be perceived. But since there's only one perceiver, and so all the perceiver can do is perceive itself. There's only one substanding being, and all it can do is perceive itself. And in the perceiving of itself, all the details in the great relationship we call Mahamaya are generated. Those, in other words, universal detail is generated through self sight, in which the self is the universal logos. Now, we can carry it beyond the universe as well. And we will say that there is also the self, I'm going to change the capitalization, self-sight of the trans-universal absolute deity. But I'll stay away from that for a little while. Suffice it to say, it's all happening inside us, if we can use a word like inside. And that's why I want to work on changing the meaning of the word me. Let's think about that for just a second. I want to work on changing the meaning of the word me. Usually it's such a tiny formal thing with all the traits and characteristics that we have learned to identify in our physical image and in our social interplay, you know, in our emotions, in our pattern of our thought. It's usually so tiny and so formal. But when the Tibetan says, "Naught is but me," he's dropping all of that minuscule formality. He's really dropping it. So with this mantra, the Tibetan drops the minuscule formality. Spell that word. Minuscule? There it is. Minuscule formality. And you know, it's part of ending materialism, which is a very superficial illusion, to drop the notion that we are somehow form. We are the essence of all forms, and all forms are but self-perceptions. But we're not the form itself, not as the form appears. As if by the shape of a form, you could determine what we or anything really is. The really, or the reality behind every form, is identical. So what I'd like to do is just use a couple of, spend some moments to practice a type of less bounded identity. If we can't practice exactly non-boundedness, then let us at least practice less bounded identity. Now you might ask, you know, what good is this going to do me as I go through life and have to deal with form and have to deal with the great science of relations and with the Maya with which I am constantly surrounded, using that term in the old sense. I'm hoping that you've been hearing me. if for any reason you have not been hearing me, Michael, this is the time to speak.
We have been hearing you, Michael.
Okay. I have one little button that erases all sound. And if I'm not careful, I can carry on like Charlie Chaplin for a long time. So we can practice a less bounded identity. Why do it? Well, you know, everyone's going to have to answer that question for themselves. But you can understand that so many of the great sages have done this. The Buddha did it, and, you know, he came up with this quality or factor, anyway, that he called suchness. And maybe other people call it thatness, as in the old Vedantic, thou art that. It gives a kind of intimacy which Maya does not. It gives a kind of universal participation which being subject to Maya does not give. And basically, it takes us ever closer to the reality we are. So I just want to meditate on a few little seed thoughts. And the first seed thought, once we begin to imagine that we are the pervasive factor, everywhere identical. Once we begin to imagine that, because the imagination, whether it has form in it or just some sort of formless apprehension, is very important in this work. I want to say this statement that I have here as number 9. I want to say and have us ponder it a bit. What do I mean by ponder? It's not necessarily shuffling a bunch of words around your head. It's an attunement, really, isn't it? The kind of pondering we have to do here is the kind of attunement. And I want the key mantra to be, you take place within me. You take place in me, you take place within me. You are occurring within me. And of course, we know the me is not the tiny myavic me. So let's have some silence on that. You take place within me. And of course, in pondering this or attuning to it, we have to realize that we have to have a special feeling about what is me-ness or I-ness. What is that really? The me you are looking for is, let's just stay with the universe, is omnipresent in universe. The me you are attempting to attune to and to become or recognize that you are, is omnipresent through the entirety of universe, this universe or any other. And I want to extend this a little bit to say, not only you, but all that I see, or let's call it register, perceive, takes place within me. All. That I register, see, register, perceive, takes place within me. And what I would say, there is no way that anything I see, register, perceive, can help but be me. There is no way that anything I see, register, or perceive can help but be me. And what is this but the ancient Vedantic saying, thou art that. So there is the universe within me, and the universe apparently, myavically, outside me. This is the old mystical Neptunian perception that destroys boundaries. You take place within me. There is no space or time separating us. What you are is omnipresent in this universe and every other and beyond, but that's another matter. All that I perceive, see, register takes place within me. There is no way that anything can see, register, perceive. Anything that I can see, register, or perceive can help but be me. And another way of saying this is nothing can escape. Being me. I'll keep the capitals. And thou art that, and then the Tibetan's statement, of course, is not is but me. And another way of saying this is all that I register as within me is me, or is I, if we want to be more formally correct. Now, that sequence of thoughts, or something like it, you know, is bringing us into an interior world. And the sort of Cartesian, you know, René Descartes, the Cartesian subject-object breaks down. The observed is the observer. That is what the Tibetan calls contemplation. And there are very many levels of contemplation. In the rules for disciples and initiates, if I can find that particular quotation, I think you'll find it interesting, but maybe an interpretation will come about it that we haven't had before. And maybe if I can switch now to this, and you'll see it's rule number 6. Let the group merged in the fifth be nourished by the sixth and seventh and realize that all the lesser rules in time and space cannot hold the group. It onward moves in life. And that's the point, that final statement. It onward moves in life. That's what it means to identify ever more deeply as the apparent object that you are contemplating, is to onward move in life. Now, you know, it's kind of poetic, and you kind of have to, you know, really ponder what can that mean, because, you know, life is unitary. Life is without parts. It's without division. So how do you onward move in life? And basically, you know, you're intensifying your own degree of identification with the only thing that is, which just happens to be what you are. So, you know, ponder on that, rule number 6. About how one day we are to onward move in life. I sometimes sense this, you know, like I'll have days, little myopic eye, when being everything, not is but me, is a little vague. And it's hard to force. But then some trigger comes along and suddenly, realization. Yes, it is that. Thou art that. And as I've said many times, the heart center, or the series of heart centers with which we are connected, is the key to this kind of identification, right within our own energy system. We have a number of heart centers, the etheric heart center between the shoulder blades and the heart center at the top of the head. And then that's repeated on the astral plane. And then the causal body is a heart center, monadic heart center. And the monad itself is a heart center, the greater 12. Whenever the zodiac, you know, whenever there's a 12, watch out, because a heart center is implicated and it embraces everything. So, you know, we have to kind of practice what we might call heart center perception, which is not the same thing as being sentimentally attracted to something or someone. You know, I like you, I don't like you, or I love you in the conventional sense, or I don't love you. That's not, you know, that's not love. But I always find for myself that the heart center, the etheric heart center, which DK tells us is the anchor for buddhi, is really the foundation of it all. And then if we onward move in life, we take advantage of those higher heart centers for intensifying perception of the one we are as everything. So it's a great act of inclusiveness in a way that we're looking at. You know, it's the second ray method, the kind that the Christ would use, not is but me. And we, you know, the furthest reaches of time, space are embraced by this type of inclusion. It's hard to imagine, but you know, it can be imagined that no matter how far back we go in exhalations of the great breath, that we are there. I don't mean this form, this appearance, this capability, this particular energy. I don't mean any of that. I mean, the we, the I, are there. No matter how far apparently back we go, how many instances of universal appearance we may imaginatively consult, we are there. We, the I, is there. And so for on ahead, no matter where we go in apparently expansive space, and you know, we no astronomer of our kind knows how expansive space is. You know, we know that we're reached by light from incredibly distant sources, and we're only now receiving that light. But we don't know the dimensions of the universe. We have approximations, and then we're not even thinking about the universe within, not yet anyway. The universe within is another matter. And we're not really thinking about that. We're just thinking about, as materialists tend to think, of what appears to be a universe. Stars, galaxies, you know, that kind of thing. But the interiority of things, that escapes us. And the most interior of all, let me call it non-things, is this me-ness, this being, this omnipresent substance, this omnipresent suchness everywhere present in universe and beyond. And, you know, it's such a stretch compared to how we usually think. And many will be the times when we fail to grasp it. It happens to me all the time. I kind of get myself ready for it and it slips away from me. But there will be times, if you breathe with the heart, as it were, at least imaginatively, the me-ness that is all things, the I-ness that is all things, will suddenly appear. And you will have the dual ability to see apparent difference while you simultaneously know, K-N-O-W, non-difference, sameness. To perceive otherness, difference, division, while simultaneously perceiving non-otherness, non-division. It's kind of a dual identificatory process, or it's a perceptual and identificatory process. Now, you know, the fullness of all that lies ahead of us in time and space. We are not yet planetary logoi, nor solar logoi, nor cosmic logoi on our emanative journey. We haven't retracted that far yet back to our original somethingness, but we will. And then as a result of doing that, we will onward move in life and, you know, intensify our perception of beingness, which is to intensify our perception of and identification as I-ness or me-ness. You know, you can use the subject or the object. At this point, it doesn't make any difference. So, you know, even 5 minutes a day, if you have it, to practice being the far less bounded self than you usually think you are. You know, think about all our aspirations. You know, we aspire to this initiation or that initiation, or to this role or that role, and this sphere of responsibility, and we want to do that. And all of that is in the relative world, the world of relativity. And we have to do it, but behind it all is what the theologian Paul Tillich called the ground of all being. And, you know, if we get good at that and practice that kind of identification, we are going to do something very odd. We're going to collapse all time and collapse all space in our perception. Okay, well, we've had some, you know, these are some deep matters. And sometimes these little sentences, these little mantras can be socially valuable in terms of right human relations. You know, if I look at someone that I'm not getting along with very well in my own littleness, and I say, you cannot escape being me, that's going to have an effect. on this sense of I am I and you are you, and we are enemies. So, or friends, you know, it's beyond good and evil, really. So sometimes these little mantras, these little seed thoughts, which is why I'd like to write this book. I've got so much material, it's just a question of organizing it with a little help from my friends. So that people can use these little seed thoughts to change their perception, and sometimes to understand philosophically a little bit more, because some of the thoughts do go on a little bit and take the philosophical approach. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say along this line for tonight. Tonight here in Europe. And I'll be happy to, you know, make any attempt to hear your thoughts or answer questions, you know, realizing, of course, my limitations in the answering of anything. Don't forget, we're just, in the words of the Tibetan, we are microscopic man. Microscopic. I guess if you get far enough out there in space, you don't see little men moving around, do you? Or any, you don't even see big animals moving around, you know. We have become, through withdrawal, pratyahara, abstraction, we've become microscopic. So, Michael, if you'd be so kind as to field any questions, if there are any thoughts where people want to say anything.
Yes, I'm keeping an eye out for hands raised and things in the chat box. In the meantime, I've put some things in the chat box concerning upcoming events for tomorrow, Saturday, Sunday.
Right. Good. Good, because we have the Sirius Leo activities coming up, so hope you find time to join us. And we're pretty well going to use Zoom so we can have up to, you know, more people than go to meeting.
There has been a change in the registration for the pre-full moon meeting. It initially went out on GoToMeeting, and it has been changed to Zoom, new registration link on Zoom to accommodate up to 300 people.
Probably will get 199 maybe. Okay. All right. Back to the universal. Is there anybody that would like to ask anything, say anything? Or do you just want to kind of dwell with the thoughts? Because
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. The definition of universe versus the definition of cosmic. Could you elaborate on that?
I look at them. The universe is the great entirety. Any one great entirety with the largest bounded entirety. Maybe I can put that down somehow here. A universe is the largest bounded entirety. And we can use cosmos in the same way. Except it implies the principle of order. But when we say cosmic, it's a little different, perhaps, than universal. When we say cosmic, we mean of large scale within the universe. Cosmic is of large scale within a universe, but is not necessarily, could be, but is not necessarily ultimate, of ultimate scope within a universe. So if I'm dealing with the fact that a planetary logos is a cosmic being, which he does say, and so is the solar logos, and so is a cosmic logos, and so forth, we're dealing with beings of large scope within the grand entirety. But I think that when we say the universe, it means the same as the entirety of cosmos, because cosmos has a little bit of a connotation of being potentially less than universal, and can deal with universal spreads throughout the grand entirety, the grand bounded entirety. But the use of the word cosmic as an adjective does not necessarily spread throughout the entire universe. So the term universal, but of course it really should be, means to spread throughout the grand bounded entirety. It's got to be the bounded part, because the unbounded is super universal. Cosmos can mean that entirety, but as an adjective, it may signify something much larger than man, but smaller than the universal being, logos being. So it's just a question of connotation, really, with, for me, if I use the word universal as an adjective, it means more to me than cosmic as an adjective. It means a greater expanse. Now, if I specify, however, and I'll say like something like universal throughout the solar system, universal throughout the one about whom naught may be said, then I've limited the term universal. But if I just use the word universal, it seems to embrace the entirety of the universe. And if I use the word cosmic as an adjective, it does not necessarily embrace the entirety of the universe. So the words are very close, but the connotation, for me anyway, is as I try to explain.
Thank you very much.
Hey, by the way, you know, we're going into a period called the Aquarian Age, the age of universality. And basically it means an age in which the wholeness of various progressive wholes is appreciated, is somehow taken into consideration. It doesn't really for a minute mean that we're going to have a universal consciousness in the ultimate sense. It's just that great wholenesses will appear to us increasingly, and whatever exists within such a wholeness will be a legitimate study. So, you know, it's a little, you know, it's a little bit according to the connotation you want to give. what's his name? Who was the guy who did The Astronomer? You know, he had a show, and
Carl Sagan, perhaps.
That's exactly the guy. And you know, every time he said the word cosmos, you know what I mean? You could tell he was talking about the whole universe, you know. But maybe not everybody uses it the way he did. He was just thrilled by the grandeur of the idea of what the universe was. And I also want to say that in the old days, the word universe meant something much smaller. I'm just telling you what I think it means. Sometimes we've looked at our solar system, and even in DK you kind of see that, and it means the wholeness of the solar system, the universe. And look at what they say about galaxies. Island universes. Okay? Island universes, a form into which you and I are poured, universe. So there's flexibility in the use of these terms, and if you want to be specific, maybe it's wise to be as specific as possible when you're using such a term and have a little bit of additional explanation.
Was it Descartes who said, if you want to speak with me, define your terms?
It was a Frenchman, I think it was Voltaire, but wouldn't you know it, the French with their fifth-ray soul and their third-ray personality would say just such a thing, you know. Descartes said, as we know, I think, therefore I am, and the esotericist says, I am, therefore I think. So it's a bit of a turnaround. The French are very precise and very proud of their mind, you know. And DK says that's a problem, but it's also an advantage.
Moving on, Martine has written, is the not but me the same as I am that I am?
You can interpret I am that I am as kind of a biblical phrase, as equivalent to not is but me. In other words, the that is the all-encompassing substance which not is but me is indicating. So when the Upanishads, the Vedantas, you know, the philosophers among the Vedic group say, I am that I am, or let's just say, they even stop and just say, I am that. They really do mean there's nothing else but the that, and I am that, that. So I think you could come close enough to making an equivalence between not is but me and I am that I am. Wasn't it Moses that asked the name of God? And the reply came, I am that I am.
That's correct.
You know, and it's kind of circular too, isn't it? You know, it's not exactly I am that and that am I. I mean, you could interpret it, but more enigmatical is I am that I am. I am that I am. You can play with those words. So I would say, yes, the answer is close enough, yes.
Heike writes, the Cambridge Dictionary says, cosmos is the universe considered as a system with an order and pattern.
The order and pattern part is really important because, you know, it's kind of interesting, the attitude of the Pythagoreans towards infinity. It wasn't an entirely accepting attitude. They wanted order. And therefore they were dealing with cosmos and not necessarily with the number two as the foundation of that which is immeasurable. So when we talk about cosmos, to include the factor of pattern and order is an important inclusion. Now, you know, look, whatever they define in these dictionaries, it's very good to know the fifth ray is hard at work making the definitions. Esotericists might see it a different way. And so we have to understand what the esoteric definition of these things might be and not accept as the final authority even those who have edited the great dictionaries. But yeah, I bought at one time for $125, it was long ago, Monier Williams Sanskrit Dictionary. This is an example of thinking far ahead of one's capabilities. It is this thick and unassuming brown cover, and everything that he could say about the Sanskrit language, which was plenty. So he's one of the ultimate authorities, and I suppose he got it from, I can't remember the name of the Indian from India who was the main compiler of the language. I would maybe recognize it if it was spoken to me. Monier Williams, I think he was an Englishman, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was the reincarnation of that particular individual.
At this point, there are no hands raised and no additional comments written in the chat box.
Okay. Now, you know, it's such a different kind of pursuit that we're on here. Our pursuit, you know, it's not a specifically mental meditation. It's a heart within the head meditation, a heart center meditation that we are pursuing. And it's just ever so subtle. Really, it's an insubstantial substance. In other words, every time we talk about substance, we think about stuff, material, some kind of energy. It's beyond any such definition. And it comes upon one as a surprise. But I think that what certain students of esotericism who want to do this can make the surprise a more frequent occurrence. It would be nice to be able to go through a day, every day, and have at least the intimation of this presence. Now, maybe it's not so different from the Jesuits practicing the presence of God. But there's still a big duality there, you know. The present is more the presence of me, the presence of me that we're practicing. And then we're into that heresy, which they think it is a heresy, and it contradicts the great heresy of separateness, that all there is God, and that God is you, and no one can escape being God. Now, that would go way, way beyond what the Jesuits meant when they say practice the presence. And yet it is a presence. There's a difference when the present is present and when the present, when the presence is not present. And this is the mystics write about being in God and out of God. So basically they say, you know, even a fly in God is worth a palace out of God. I mean, I'm just making up that kind of comparison. The switch, the in-God switch, is the in-me switch. It is the idea that it's all taking place in me, who is the presence, who is God. And that is, it's just such an instantaneous reversal of perception, you know, that it's really worth being alert to and cultivating. I can hardly think of anything that is more worthwhile in the realm of perception or in the realm of infusception, if I can use that word that I've tried to use when perceiving sameness everywhere. So just be aware of very subtle changes. Now, people might say, well, you're switching into soul consciousness. That's what's happening. And to a degree, that's correct. But it's more correct to say that we are shifting into the consciousness of the spirit monad. That the monadic awareness for a split second, you might call it, and it has been called, the blinking of the dragon's eye. At first, you know, it's pretty quick. Oh, was that it? But after a while, the dragon of wisdom keeps his eye open all the time. And, you know, it goes back to the prophet, one of the prophets, I don't know. The statement is from the Elijah oratorio, he watching over Israel slumbers not nor sleeps. It's the opened eye. And it is one of the beautiful choral pieces in the Deutsches Requiem, you know, the Brahms Requiem, which I would really, if you want to really experience somebody who knew their Bible and was a wonderful musician, go to the Brahms Requiem, because in a way it's anything but a requiem. It's really a tremendous celebration of divinity. So be aware of subtle changes, very subtle, and kind of start the day, if amidst all of the troubles of the day, you can clear your consciousness, start the day in that state of alertness where the infusception of sameness everywhere in the universe can suddenly blink in, even if it disappears quickly. Then we'll be in a position to always perceive that. So, I saw Alexander's hand. Is that correct, Michael?
That's correct. And then Aike has followed up this line of conversation with a couple additional comments.
Okay. You want to give them?
You want Aike's?
Okay. So let's see. Alexander wanted to speak, right? And then
right,
and has written something. So
Alexander has not written anything, but Alexander, you can unmute yourself.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. I want to appreciate that little meditation that we had, and it's a beautiful shift of from this very high abstract to very practical, of listening to the silence within yourself and then recognizing the same silence within the other, that presence of the presence, and recognizing that it's the same oneness in us. And I think it's in itself, it's just a beautiful short meditative alignment that can be used.
Thank you. Thank you, Sasha. I think silence is really a very important word or concept or state when it comes to the synthesis and the presence. Because, you know, if you want a silence, utter silence, there really can be no division. And synthesis is that which detects the non-divisibility of apparently divided perceptions. So the whole concept of the inner silence and attuning with it, of course, language, you know, it's always going to give us subject, object, you know, it's all based on division, but we try to read beyond that, think beyond that. If we can touch what silence offers, silence and presence really go together, and so does our being. Silence, presence, and our being, or what we are, the I, the me, they all go together. And the more profound the silence, the greater the possibility of identification. And, you know, that's one of the things when the Christ returns, teaching, you know, many specific things that will start to take over certain human beings so that they can, like he could or can, know what was in man. He could just go through the apparent barriers. So he knows and is able to transcend these artificial boundaries. So, you know, we could say that among human beings, the Christ is in a way the most boundaryless of the initiates, as his ability with identification shows. So when we go high, we have to be able to go lower too, and that's not so easy all the time, but it is desirable if we manage to have straight knowledge of the intuition to be able to apply it even on the lowest plane in some constructive manner. So thank you for your thought on that. And you know, everybody, it's like building the Atacarana. Up to a point, DK can tell you how to do it. And then after that, it's really up to every individual or later group or planet or whatever. But start with the individual. It's up to every individual to work with that bridge of light until the unfamiliar way becomes the familiar way. Nobody's going to tell us how to do it, really. Thanks for your thoughts, Alexander. Now we have something from Heike, and I saw Nicholas arrive too. And
yes, Heike writes, the Tat Tavam Asi in the Chandogya Upanishads, you are that are you, is meaning the same, right?
Yeah, that's it. Tat Tavam Asi, yeah, that's it. When I wrote my book on infinity, I pretty well had that as the foundational sentence. And what Shankara, I think it was Shankara, said that out of those three words come 10,000 books. You know, in the old days when they wanted to indicate a big number, they said 10,000, you know. But it's true that out of those simple words, Tattvamasi, come so many commentaries and things that can be said, elaborations and so forth. But of course, what we really want is the kernel of truth that is expressed, thou art that, Tattvamasi. We want that always to be ringing within our consciousness until it becomes a fact. And a almost, we might say, a continuous fact in our consciousness. And I would tend to call that the path to monadic awareness, or an aspect of monadic awareness. So yes, the same, yes.
And then she writes after that, after the blinking of the dragon's eye, even for a split second, the perception of the outer world changes.
Yes, yes. You know that even when it's hidden temporarily from your consciousness, it's there. And the memory of it has stirred the consciousness, and a path, however slight, has been created. Now, it's so interesting that masters are called minor dragons of wisdom, and planetary logoi are called dragons of wisdom. And then the very first path on the way of higher evolution features a green dragon. And, you know, it's somehow related to Earth service. And then, you know, other deities have other names, like the lion of cosmic will for our solar logos. But we are at least on our way to becoming minor dragons of wisdom, and we're waking up with the eye open to what is always to be registered, the great revelation of reality. And right now, you know, it's pretty intermittent, if even when you practice it. It's a now and then thing. But increasingly, the eye is opened. And then we are not just by happenstance in that state of awareness. We can go there deliberately. In fact, we don't have to leave that state. So that's what we're striving for. And I could say, you know, that it is the state of awareness of the higher initiations, but lower down the scale of resonance, we can begin to get some kind of anticipatory vibration, I'll call it that, of what it will be like when we take these higher initiations. I mean, you know, look, you're on your own. You're swimming in the big ocean here, you know? This is not like studying the great science of relations. There, everything is marked out by the fifth ray, and it's beautifully delineated. Here, the delineations begin to dissolve. It's more of a Neptunian approach. Neptune being a very powerful planet with its second ray monad in this particular solar system, and Christ is called Neptune. So we're using the Christ method of identification. And last time we were together, I read you the final statements, the final mantric statements of all seven approaches. And it was all about unveiling and how the obvious no longer veils the subtle. So naught is but me, though, is connected with the second ray. I'm sorry, Michael, didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Margot has written into the chat box, something coming from nothing, or perhaps she means no thing.
No thing. Yeah, there's a difference between the little nothing, which is a vacuity, and in a way, it doesn't even exist. The little nothing doesn't exist, but the no thing, or the final sub-standing one, the final sub-stance, that's the no thing. And it contains all somethings in without articulating them. By articulate, I mean divide into forms and so forth. In the no thing, there is no articulation, but in that which the no thing sponsors or underlies or somehow sustains, that's where the articulation begins, in the field of absolute infinity, which is the self perception of the absolute infinite deity. So there is the substance, and then there is the absolute infinite deity with its infinitude of articulations and its boundlessness. You know, these are big philosophical terms, and it's just a reach on our part. And we can say we are reaching from multiplicity to unity or sameness. It, you know, if we want to simplify the whole thing, we're looking for the great one and only sameness, from which all multiplicity arises and from which, to which all multiplicity returns. That is maybe an easy way of saying what we're trying to do here. And then, of course, there is the factor of selectivity for each universe and the theme of whatever universe. And it seems like quite a free choice on the part of the transcendental deity. There's no compulsion there that the next universe has to be thus and so. It seems like the one completely free choice of what the nature of the next universe will be. Okay.
No more hands raised and nothing else written in the chat box at this point.
Okay. Then let's close with the great invocation. You know, I say that's really bringing it down to earth, you know, because we do work in the realm of the Mahamaya. You know, considering it the way the Vedantins consider it, not this still more technical method that the Tibetan considers when dealing with the energies of the etheric plane. We're talking about the whole world of universal form being the Mahamaya. It is the great illusion. And even though we get rid of many illusions, as long as we live as an aspect of the universe, we are still confined to what I call the great illusion. But, you know, if we entertain these thoughts along with our study of the science of relations, we will achieve that no-thing, something, something, no-thing, will achieve this revelatory balance between the first two fundamentals of the secret doctrine, the fact that there's no-thing and the fact that there is periodicity. Contradictions, apparently, but we can feel our way into a non-contradictory state regarding those first two fundamentals. And by the way, there will be seven fundamentals. Three have emerged, and fourth is emerging, and they emerge one per round. That's how important and how big they are. It's not just like, well, let me sit down and think about the fifth, sixth, and seventh fundamental of the secret doctrine. No, with every round, the remaining fifth, sixth, and seventh will come a new fundamental of the secret doctrine, and even the fourth fundamental is not yet really articulated. That's a little bit beside the point, and it's a bit in the cosmic fire range. But this way of thinking and the cosmic fire in-depth process are quite related, truly. Okay. So here's the great invocation, and let us together sound it.
Change your screen, please.
Gosh, will I ever learn? There it is. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light worked out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Tomorrow morning, dissipation of glamour. Tomorrow evening, the in-depth work with the secret doctrine. And then we'll be launching into the serious Leo activities. And Michael, where could people go to get that? Will they be sent it, or is there also a place to go to see what's coming up?
The Soul of Nations meditation broadcast will occur Saturday morning. The Attracting Resources for Hierarchical Purposes is canceled due to the Sirius Leo festival work. I put in the chat box a link for the first meeting at 1 p.m. GMT on Sunday, mm-hmm. and the link for the pre-full moon meeting on Sunday at 8 p.m. GMT. Joe Waltz will be sending out an entire list of the Leo full moon Sirius festival meeting links, and I will be following up with some changes to this week's calendar and Sunday putting out next week's calendar, which will include those links as well.
It sounds good. Is there any place where the calendar is shown other than that people receive it?
That's still in process of creation.
Okay. Okay. Great. Well, thank you. Thank you, everyone. And let's carry on and move forward in this universe in which there is no real movement. Another paradox. See you later. And thank you for attending.